Welcome back to PedScrit. I'm Zach Hodges, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C. Today, we have a really personal and important story of an intensivist who lost his own child. Dr. Ethan Sanford really goes into his experience in really this past year and the way that it changed what he brought to the bedside for his patients and their families.
Yes. Dr. Ethan Sanford is an assistant professor of anesthesia and pediatrics at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas. He completed his medical degree at Harvard University, followed by anesthesiology residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital and pediatric anesthesia fellowship at Boston Children's Hospital. After completion of that, he then moved to UT Southwestern in Dallas, where he completed his pediatric critical care fellowship. He is now a practicing pediatric anesthesiologist and intensivist with me here in Dallas. He's an exceptional clinician and extremely thoughtful, and I really enjoyed speaking with him today.
Yes, let's get right to the episode.
Welcome back to the PedScrit podcast. We are so excited today to be speaking with Dr. Ethan Sanford. Ethan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much. I'm a big fan. I listen to you guys often while running in the morning, so it's a real pleasure to be on here with you.
Oh, well, we appreciate that. Before we get started with the interview, can you tell our listeners about yourself, including who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Ethan Sanford. I am a critical care physician in pediatrics as well as an anesthesiologist, so took a little bit of a longer, more specialized training path. I do about 60% in the ORs and 40% in the ICUs, and my interest broadly for academic purposes are ECMO, specifically neurologic outcomes on ECMO, as well as racial disparities in critical care and perioperative care.
And Ethan, you have an incredible story, and you shared this in the May 2023 edition of JAMA that when I read it the first time, I just knew that I had to speak with you about it and had to share this story with our listeners. And to get the meat of the conversation started, will you please tell us the story of your daughter, Ceci?
Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, I got a lot of positive feedback on the article, and I think when these sort of things happen to people, there's this instinctual urge to try to get people to understand what you've been through. And so I find people are oftentimes worried to ask me about Ceci, which is, I think, a product of them not wanting to bring back memories or cause harm in some way. But I think for me, at least, and I think it's pretty common amongst grievers, you know, we always think about our kids. So the opportunity to talk about Ceci and to write about her is something that I've found important, and I'm happy to give some details on that process. If I get emotional about it, I will always try to warn people. For me, actually, it's not bothersome. You know, I get emotional thinking about Ceci pretty often. But I find it sometimes to be distracting for listeners, and or it might scare off people as I'm talking with them. So I want to ensure people that it's not like causing me any excess harm or issues. So yeah, Ceci was our third daughter. She has two older sisters. She was born at a time that was pretty busy in our lives, right as we were starting or, you know, getting our feet off as attendings. And so, you know, every kid is busy in a lot of work, and Ceci was certainly no different. But she was by far our most social baby. You know, I think it's always funny thinking about your prior kids and your experiences with them. And I think a hard time for new parents is in that first few months when kids aren't giving so much of the smiles, and it's more so the labor of bringing a kid up and trying to keep them healthy and keep them growing. But Ceci was a little bit different in that she was a smiler and a hugger and a cuddler pretty early. And I think that's the thing I think most about now when I think about Ceci. We started to notice that she had some difficulties with her right leg was the primary problem that we found early. I remember bouncing her in a jumper and noticing that she never wanted to put her right leg down. And so as a pediatrician, of course, your mind wanders to some of the scary stuff, but also trying to also calm the situation, because most of the time these things end up being benign. So we saw our pediatrician, we got x-rays, we got some initial labs, but really the problem kept getting worse. And so one of the benefits, I guess, of being a pediatrician in a large academic center is the access. So we actually had one of a friend of ours, who's a pediatric neurologist. I won't give their name out since I didn't ask them ahead of time. But they came and saw Ceci and agreed with us that maybe there was something off and that we needed to pursue an MRI. So on Halloween last year, got the MRI, and it showed a large tumor involving her sacral and lumbar spinal nerves, which of course was, I don't know if shock's the right word. It's, when I think about those times, it's hard to even recall the mindset, because, you know, it's impossible really to get there without being there. So even now, after going through it, it's hard for me to even evoke what that feeling was. Certainly fear, mostly of her suffering and like going through chemotherapy and surgeries. And so we did go through some initial biopsies and were very confused to find that it wasn't in fact a malignant tumor, but an abnormal growth of the nerve itself, as well as the tissue around the nerves. We had advanced genetics testing on all that material, had friends across the country. So we actually sent the histology as well as genetics to a couple other places. And there was no consensus as to the diagnosis. So that was mixed, sort of bittersweet. And I think that's sort of a theme throughout this experience, was a lot of bittersweet even now. But we, after not being able to determine a diagnosis, you know, that's good news in some ways. We didn't think it was something that was going to necessarily progress very quickly. But we also didn't know what the long-term prognosis was, especially in regards to her mobility. So we were making plans around how we were going to deal with that, how we were going to best serve her to give her the best shot. She went for an MRI and did well, woke up, ate and drank, played for a few hours, and then we put her to bed for a nap and she never woke up. So how or why that happened, we don't know. There's some amount of angst that comes with that. But really being mindful of it and thinking through it, I think it has provided a lot of insight into the fact that we all sort of delude ourselves in thinking we have control over the things that happen to us or the things that happen to those we love. And while it does at times seem more cruel the way she passed away, at this point, I don't know that why someone dies has become less important to me than the time we spend with them and what we can take away from it. So that was, that's a brief synopsis of what Ceci's life was, like the factual things that occurred around her, which obviously has led to, you know, a lot of reconsideration of my own life, how I treat my kids, as well as how I work as a physician, which, you know, is what I hope can be gained a little bit from, especially this audience who cares for these types of situations and kids and families in terrible situations so often.
Ethan, it's a testament to just how strong of an individual you are that you're able to recount such a horrific, and it was a nightmare. I can't imagine, you know, as a physician and a father myself, I absolutely cannot imagine what you went through. And I think there is so much that I personally can learn from hearing about your experience, and certainly would love to share many more aspects of that with our listeners today. If you don't mind, I'd just like to ask you a quick question about, when I think about my identity as a father and a physician, I mean, so much of that is wrapped up in protecting and providing for my children. And I just would like to know, will you tell us what it was like for you personally in the time after Ceci's diagnosis with that? Tell us about that, I would imagine, that presumed feeling of helplessness that comes with your child being diagnosed with something that's potentially life-limiting.
Yeah, and that is the brunt of what I was really writing about when I wrote about Ceci, and at least my initial grief around it. I think, you know, you reference not being able to imagine, and it's true that It's hard to imagine that initial suffering, that initial few days. And what I've experienced and what I've talked to with other parents subsequently is that it does feel a lot like shame. I think that there is something instinctual about having kids that you always plan around your kids and what they are going to do and how you are going to support them until you die rather than the other. And a child dying earlier than expected, it feels like you did something wrong. And, you know, there are scenarios and families that I've talked with where there might have been something that occurred that could have been prevented. In our particular situation, I'm not quite sure how things could have been prevented. But despite that, there was still this overwhelming, really shame that came with it. And it did force a lot of self-reflection on identity. And so what I wrote about, you know, in talking with Jonathan and talking through his experiences with his own family and how he reflected on his time with me, I got some insight into the fact that what I can control, and what I can't, I can't. And that my identity and even identity as a concept for each of us is a bit flawed. You know, we are people, we do things. How we identify, what does that truly mean? And in fact, those things can change, and they do change for all of us drastically over time, sometimes more quickly, sometimes more slowly. And so in some ways, I think having an identity may prevent your ability to really pursue the activities that will bring most meaning in your life. And for me, sort of identifying as this protector or, you know, someone who is going to be able to prevent anything bad from happening to those around me, learned pretty quickly that that was a flawed notion. And rather than identifying as someone, I don't really identify myself as a doctor. I don't really identify myself as someone who lives in Texas. Like, you know, where you live, what you do, those aren't necessarily, those shouldn't determine how you act or where you find meaning. And instead, the daily exercise and the daily work to make yourself the person you want to be and the person that you want your family to be around. I think those are much more important endeavors than really identifying as some certain aspect of something that you've been doing or what you've been taught.
Right.
Especially after dual training and being in Boston and coming down as a new attending, I feel I'm hearing a bit of a transformation in identity when it came to Ceci and ultimately what happened. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And, you know, I think all of us go through these many transformations and major ones. The birth of your kids is certainly a transformation. I reflect sometimes on how selfish I was generally as a human being. And this is as someone who was training, trying to take care of kids in the hospital by sort of outside standards, probably someone who would be considered a very selfless person, but internally incredibly selfish in dominating my own time with the things I wanted to do at all times. And then you have a newborn and all of that goes out the window. And so what you were doing previously certainly quickly gets called into question. And this was an experience similar to that in many ways, transformationally. Even now, reflecting on before Ceci died, I was, I would argue, maybe a little bit selfish as a parent. I thought about the things that I was missing out on, you know, missing out on travel or friends or the things that, not to be overly pejorative, but the things you see on social media as the things you should be pursuing in life. And I felt like maybe I was missing out on that and at times pretty resentful about it. And then after Ceci died, I realized the things I wanted most was to spend time with my kids. And so it definitely turned a switch in my brain about what is truly meaningful and what carries. And in that way, I'm extremely grateful for the experience. And so when I think of Ceci, I'm still sad at times, but I'm thankful for the perspective gained. And I know that it came in a way that I didn't want it to, but I think it has improved how I act on a daily basis. And really selfishly, the joy I get out of my time with my family, my kids, and my work life. And that sort of transformation in how I think about things has been I think, the biggest change in me.
Ethan, before the recording today, Alice and I were chatting, and I made a comment about how you're an extremely skilled physician, and being a trainee here at UT Southwestern, it's a pleasure to be able to work with you. And I'd say the skills that you bring to the bedside are aspirational for someone like me. And I'd really like to very sensitively ask this question and get your insight, which much as you'd like to share, about what it was like caring for your daughter during that crisis.
Yeah. So, you know, even from the time of diagnosis, there is a shared sort of dual model of being the parent and the physician. And so I, on a consistent basis, was trying to judge how can I decrease risk the most while trying to ensure that we're doing everything we can to get the best results we can. And a lot of that before her death was centered around physical therapy and occupational therapies and trying, you know, I read a book, A Heart That Beats, and in it, this was about a child who had had brain cancer and ended up having severe neurologic issues. And they talk about sort of all of these physical therapy regimens that you're going through. And it is astonishing how big of a fan and how incredibly stressful it is having a kid going through these physical therapy exercises and just hoping every day that things get a little bit better. And then the time around her death, especially that day, initially there's shock when, so essentially my wife came and grabbed me because she had gone in to check on her. And I went in there and wasn't quite sure what was going on and quickly noticed that something was gravely wrong. And so asked them to leave while I got her out of the bed and then told them to call EMS. And so, you know, performing resuscitation, it's strange when I think about it because I can see why an audience or why the lay public might see that is a very traumatic circumstance. I don't reflect on it in that way. And I don't know if that's because as an IC physician, fairly regularly, we're part of these resuscitations. And so the mechanics of doing that, that's less bothersome to me for some reason. And I think it might be because of prior experience, as well as generally an effort to de-emphasize it in my own brain. I think a brain sort of learns how to take care of itself, or maybe more appropriately, when there's concerted effort to heal, part of that is not to, I think, get hung up on those details. And for us, when she had passed away and CPR had been going on for about 30, 45 minutes, it was very clear to us that she wasn't going to be the person that we had been with a few hours previously. And so being aware of that and seeing the consequences of that sort of resuscitation and the neurologic injuries associated, I remember even talking to my wife as we were in the emergency department. I told her that there is no good outcome from what has happened. And in that way, we walked into the resuscitation bay and asked if we could hold her, knowing that even any possibility of return of circulation wasn't necessarily within our goals for her, which I think is probably very different than, unfortunately, what a lay person might understand about that scenario. And it does give me a little bit, maybe more temerity and when I talk with parents about those situations, because I know where I stand and I know I have knowledge that they might not have. So those might have been a bit different than what we typically deal with in patients and in our reaction to it. So then when we held her in the emergency department, then that's more when you're in the parent role of grieving. But certainly the time right around that, I don't know, it just felt more like common sense than it did any sort of huge emotional decision. It was just clear that what had happened. And then from that time on, our family has more or less agreed that after the first week, perseverating on the who, the what, when, the how wasn't very helpful to us. And I sometimes encourage families who I speak with who are going through loss that debating or having a lot of discussion about what led to this may not be helpful.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate you highlighting your experience of in the moment, just like when you're leading a code well, you're not leading the code, you're just getting what you need for the patient in front of you. In the moment, my daughter lost her pulse and I was providing resuscitation. That's it, right? Like getting her what she needed and not the meta of this is my child.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's all sort of things going through your head. And in the moment, I have a hard time even reflecting about how I was thinking at that time. But subsequently, I don't tend to get hung up on it. And some of that is concerted effort because if my mind ever drifts there, mm-hmm. it's sort of like that's the inspiration to go for a run or do something different. And that's where sort of those maybe mitigation strategies are a bit more helpful.
And I think one theme of what I wanted to share with the listeners today is just how you navigate feelings of grief, especially after death of someone so close to you. And do you have any lessons learned to share about navigating grief and maybe the shame that you mentioned?
Yeah. In my mind, I now separate it really into the acute grief and then the sort of recovery, ongoing living with this. So in the acute grief, which is 1 to 2 weeks, something like this, it's so hard to understand how life is supposed to then function. And there's constant reminders. So we have a walk-in closet near our bedroom, and so she slept there. So every time I walked into my bedroom, I instinctually knew I need to quiet down or else I'm going to wake up Ceci. And I would say for the first month or so, every time I walked into the room, I would get that sensation. And each time, you know, that was difficult. So I think that kind of acute pain, I think everyone suffers a little bit differently in that. I think there is an instinct to close off. And during that time period, at the same time, you want everyone to know that nothing is okay with you. I think about there's several different traditions around this. And in Jewish tradition, you know, you wear the same clothes and you rip them. And everyone who walks in and sees you, which happens on a nightly basis in that tradition, they see you with your torn clothes. In some traditions, you shave your head. And there's all these things that during that time, to me, it felt like you wanted to eliminate anything that reminded you of your former life, or you want to make clear that something terrible has happened to you. So, you know, I did shave my head. You know, you're not eating, so you're losing weight. You're not really bathing. And I think transitioning out of it, I think those sort of rituals in some ways did help. At first, we didn't want to have any sort of memorial or funeral. It just felt too artificial. But we were sort of convinced by our family and friends that we needed to do something. So we had a memorial at our house a couple weeks after. And it was a bizarre experience. It felt like a bizarro wedding because we had family and friends that we hadn't seen in years. People flew in from all over the country. And, you know, seeing them was certainly gave a lot of joy. But at the same time, the reasons behind it obviously made it just very strange. But I think for us, that was actually very helpful sort of because it sort of shut the door on it. And it gave us a sort of a mental swing from, okay, we've gotten through this acute phase. And you sort of make promises to each other as a family as to how you're going to recover. And the other thing that we thankfully had was our kids. I sometimes think about people who lose their firstborn, and I think there needs to be special consideration for those families. So when we lost Ceci a couple days after, we had spent the night in a hotel for a couple nights because we didn't know how we were going to bear to be around our kids. And I don't know, that might have been a mistake because as soon as we were around our kids, it made like, oh, this is why we're still here and this is why things are going to be okay. And I'll never forget playing basketball with my oldest daughter a couple days after. It was probably the first time I smiled or, you know, felt any sort of joy. And that was really a moment where I realized like, oh, you know, I'm going to be okay. You know, we're going to make it through this. So that acute phase is quite different than the sort of current grief. I don't know what the right word for is because, you know, I still grieve Ceci and I still suffer her loss, but it's not like something that I think there's a door that shuts or something that ends. It's an ongoing understanding of self and really a development of perception about life in general. I think speaking to this sort of transformation narrative, I'm not someone in the past who would have ever, whoever really thought about my own death or the death of others. Now I don't understand how I lived without understanding that I was going to die. And I think it's almost a uniquely American culture thing too, that we think about saving lives, which is really kind of a misnomer, right? Because we all die. We're simply changing the time and the circumstance. Well, now when I think about Ceci's death, there's a bit less of that acute phase, raw, how am I going to live through this? And more so a reflection on, well, what did Ceci mean to me? And I think a bit almost in the context of, we all have family or people we love who we don't see very often, or frankly that we've lost contact completely with. And they haven't died. And certainly those memories and shared experiences still carry immense meaning and purpose to us. And so when I think of Ceci, I think of what she meant to me, and that in many ways I am her legacy, and her consciousness is really enveloped with mine. And my understanding of this world and my consciousness and how I treat people and how people treat me, oftentimes Ceci is reflected in that. And that's important to me. And so I don't want to close the door on that. I, in fact, fight to keep that. And sort of that long-term grief, I wouldn't call it suffering as much as it's really purposefully gaining meaning and insight from the life of my daughter, which is what we do with all our kids all the time. And it's why kids are so rewarding. And so, you know, I don't struggle with how could this happen, or I struggle with that. I struggle more so longing for her and longing to honor what her experience taught me. And that longing, it's strange. It feels a lot like the longing I have for my living kids. I was thinking about this the other day. I saw a picture of my kids from school, and they were very cute. And the longing, just the sheer, you know, pleading that they are happy, that they do well, that they live fulfilled lives. It's that feeling is very similar to the longing I have when I think of Ceci. And I think a lot of grievers in this situation, you start to realize that grief is love.
Wow.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the things I grieve most are not being able to dedicate time and energy to her. And so that's why sharing her story, you know, visiting her memorial, very conscientiously trying to think of the lessons learned throughout my life. That's sort of the effort that I can give to show my love for her.
You so eloquently talk through your thoughts during this incredibly difficult time, and another testament just how strong of an individual you are. And I really appreciate you sharing many of those sensitive details. As a pediatric anesthesiologist and intensivist, and a very talented one at that, you were faced with the challenge, the opportunity to come back to work and take care of kids like you knew that you wanted to do. Will you tell us a little bit about that process, what it was like getting plugged back into work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of those most important things that maybe listeners can take out of this. So we took a month off. We got away from the home, which was advice we were given. And I think overall was good advice. That acute grief and the constant reminders, I think it was good advice to try to get away from that for a little bit. When we returned home, my wife and I talked at length and decided that the healthiest thing for us to do was to get back into those activities that we find meaningful. So I'm incredibly grateful for my job. You know, what a country that I can live here, take care of kids, be given a very good salary for it, work with colleagues who care so much about helping the lives of children. I mean, it's really a pretty incredible time and to live to be able to do that. and the functionality of coming back to work was difficult. So, you know, I remember many times crying on the way to work, crying when I got to my office, being fearful of an interaction with someone who may not know what happened to me. I was always afraid of the question of, you know, how many kids do you have? What do you do? Those sorts of things. Certainly after this, I've never been good at small talk, and this makes small talk even more awkward because I'm constantly making that decision about whether to invite someone in with those sort of experiences or not. I was fearful of that at work, as well as you definitely feel as though you're a ghost and that every interaction in my own head, I was thinking about Ceci or how someone else was thinking about me and the recent loss. And that's just difficult and it takes time and it's just effort. And I think it's very similar to anything else that's difficult in life. And it got better with time. And for us, at least, getting back to work, getting up out of bed, doing those activities, trying to seek those meaningful things that make you proud of yourself, proud of your family was really important. And it led to other, I think, positive changes in my life. You know, I was a bit of a lazy, skinny, fat guy. And being able to conscientiously say, you know what, enough talking about doing the things that I think I should do and just starting to do them, like working out, setting a disciplined regimen about how I'm going to read or pursue the interest that I've always wanted to. Those were all sort of made not easier, but came into focus that there is no time like right now to start doing those things. So work was certainly part of that. And again, I'm so grateful for it. There's still all these kinds of little frustrations. You know, every time I get an email to do another net learning or some other administrative task, I've always been on the end of quite displeasured with those. But there is so much meaning in our work, and especially up in the unit, serving families. Initially, I admit that in that first 2 days, I was like, how am I ever going to care for someone else's kid? But now it just feels natural. It feels, of course, I should be doing that. My blinders have been turned off from sort of suffering. And there's certainly a lot of help that hopefully can be gained in that activity for myself. As far as the actual functionality of like those conversations with families that have also changed for me a bit. So I've been fortunate enough to care for families. And unfortunately, those families that are facing the loss of a child or an irreversible injury or a terrible injury that's going to change a child's life, I am certainly more conscientious of those situations and I would say more readily able and wanting to involve self in them. Whereas in the past, maybe I was a little bit afraid of those situations. And, you know, I think oftentimes ICU physicians were in it for the adrenaline rush of caring for an incredibly sick person going through all the physiology. But the fact is, oftentimes we fail. And we also have to be prepared for those interactions. When I'm talking with the family now, one thing I'm very conscious of is acknowledging their grief and acknowledging how terrible what's happened to them is. I think when I was going through it, I remember the ED physician who was there with us pretty soon after Ceci died came to us and said, you know, I'm so sorry, my daughter died as well. And that's sort of one of the things that seared through my brain during that time. And we both, my wife and I, grabbed him and started asking a bunch of questions. And that insight, and subsequently, for a long time, I was very eager to talk with families who had lost kids. Because again, it's just something you don't know, and you don't know how you're going to live with that. And I think providing some of that insight for families is important. I'm very careful about sharing it with families because I want to make it clear to them that I'm invested in the best outcome possible for their kid. And I could see how a family would interpret me sharing my loss as saying, well, you're going to lose this as well. And I don't want that ever to be confused. And so really, it's just after a child has died that I occasionally will share my story with them. And actually had very positive interactions with families around that. And it does shape a bit of how I approach those scenarios. And I'm just more careful to have a family tell me stories about their kid try to understand the grief they're going through because they want to be understood. I certainly did during that time. And so spending that time, I think, is very important.
One theme from today's conversation that I wanted to emphasize is that part of our job as pediatric intensive care clinicians is to recognize the grief in our families who have a severely ill child in the PICU who maybe will not make it or maybe has a severe brain injury. Acknowledging that grief is part of our job in meeting that family, and it's part of the medical care that we're providing. And I really appreciated you sharing that with us. For the trainees and the intensivists listening, do you have any recommendations or maybe lessons learned in how to help parents and family members acknowledge their grief, but also continue to find motivation and meaning to take a step forward and to continue to progress and leave this really dark time in their life?
Yeah, it certainly has changed how I think, and I think a little bit of my openness and or honesty with parents. So first and foremost is acknowledging when something's terrible that it's terrible. I think sometimes we tiptoe around parents who are facing loss because we think somehow that that's going to aggravate their grief. And even parents will vocalize that at times, you know, I don't want to talk about this. So when I'm talking to a family who's going through loss, I'm very quick to acknowledge the terrible circumstance that they're in and that I'm absolutely sorry and heartbroken that that's happening to them. And I think parents generally want to know that we understand how terrible it is. I think it's a difficult thing for a family to feel as though the medical team's just sort of making their rounds, doing their thing as they normally do, while you're sitting there in the midst of what you feel like is the end of the life as you know it. And so I'm very conscientious and careful to let them know I know that this is abysmal. And from there, when parents have said things like, I can't do this, I don't know how I'm going to live, I am much more forthright in telling them, it feels like that now, it won't in time, and you can make it through this. And so in the past, I probably would not have said something like that for fear of aggravating them, frankly, that they are telling you something and you're disagreeing with it during a time like that. And I haven't had any negative interactions from it. And so I just think it is important to let people know that you can make it through terrible things. And so I'll frequently tell parents, you know, I got into this job because I wanted to save kids' lives. And when that doesn't occur, it's awful. And if there were anything we could do to change what's happening, we would. Because oftentimes there are these moments when it feels like the medical team is in conflict with parents because a parent has difficulty facing what has happened. And so I want to let them know that I'm on their side and I wish this wasn't happening as well. And I think that establishes with them, okay, no one here just wants us to move on or just wants the bed. Like, that's not the nature of the interaction that we're having. And then at the end of life, I am a little bit more forthright and asking about their own family and their own circumstances, the other kids who they have. And for families who have other kids, I am more conscious of telling them how wonderful it is to have kids and how great kids are. Because again, for me, my other kids, my living kids, were my opportunity to start to heal. And I think that for many families is likely the case. And so I frequently will encourage families to consider their living kids and how they're going to go about doing the best they can for them. And I think that's very motivating to families to try to consider how they're going to heal from just the awful situation that they find themselves in. So those are things that I think have changed a little bit in how I talk with families. There are no evidence-based studies to guide these things, right? And so oftentimes we're left with our experiences as trainees, how we see others approach these scenarios. I think having some consideration of your own life, your own kids, your own family, and what you would feel like in that situation, I think is important. And we sometimes lose track of that. Or, you know, something I sometimes hear like, oh, we didn't want to bring it up because we don't know where the family is. And I don't know, I think it's sometimes it's laughable because the family is thinking of everything all the time. And so not talking about it just means it's not talked about, not that they're not considering it.
Certainly is very helpful to hear. I have a couple more questions before we move to the end of the conversation today. I certainly want to know if you have resources that you want to share with our listeners. Maybe first, are there any other themes or lessons learned as you reflect on your experience that you'd want to share with listeners, whether they may be trainees or maybe even senior clinicians?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mostly centered around how we find meaning in life. You know, I think a little bit about burnout in the ICU, and obviously there's been a ton of research and commentary about burnout, and the reasons for that are complex. My own experience has made me think a little bit less about what goes on my resume and more about, you know, at my eulogy, what are people going to say about me? And so when I think about how work-life balance, I think that's another misnomer. That sort of states then that work is somehow drudging and terrible and life is somehow great and a ton of fun. And oftentimes those are not so binary. And so when I'm at work, I do consider how I interact with the people around me and my coworkers. You know, I want to be the person that people know they can joke around with. They know that they can go to when they have a personal or work type problem. And then when I'm at home, I think very much about answering this email now versus in the morning. Is that going to change how much of my career expanse is going to be? Versus should I focus on playing soccer with my kid? Should I take actual joy in reading to my kid before they go to bed and not be so hung up on the fact that it's already 8 o'clock and I've got a couple things that I wanted to get done? And I think that that has definitely changed how I feel about work-life balance and realized that it's really all part of the same thing. And it's all doing things that you find meaningful, helpful, and purposeful. And that has been an important aspect of this experience for me. So if there's anything that I could say to especially young people as they get stressed about their titles and how they're advancing in their career, to realize that if you're doing something that you find meaningful and helpful, rely on that rather than those things that are going on your resume.
The intrinsic motivation and sort of bringing your whole self to both spaces.
That's incredible. And it's almost countercultural to what we're immersed in medical training. And you're always focused on that next big step up, whatever it may be. And the carrot on the stick is just beyond reach. I think hearing your perspective is so refreshing, and I certainly am so excited to share it with our listeners.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I still, you know, try to be productive and try to be the person who responds swiftly to emails. But what I have realized is that if I'm not responding to the email or I'm not, you know, excited to give my time to it, maybe it's something that I should say no to, or maybe it's something that I should put on the back burner purposefully.
As we move towards the end of the conversation, any resources that you'd like to share with our listeners?
As we were going through that initial process, there's Child Life, which we often refer to for help with having either conversations with families about other living kids, as well as memory making. Another facet of my clinical practice now that's changed is after talking with Child Life about my own loss, and going through the process of making funeral arrangements and whatnot, I think that's probably something that should be like a standard part of ICU curriculum, because it's been oftentimes that parents will ask me, you know, how do I tell my kids? And I now feel much more confident in that approach. So I don't know, I would reach out to Child Life a little bit more. I just think it's strange that we sort of outlet those important interactions to others, and maybe we should have some base knowledge of it. We live in a time where access to group counseling is much more easy to access. And there are certainly several groups who are dedicated to helping families who've lost kids find each other to guide. And so I frequently do encourage families to do that. And then when I think about my own grief and process, there are simple things like meditation and exercise that I find very helpful. And so I encourage people to explore those activities. I think I always think about doing something hard every day, both physically and mentally, and that going through something that isn't easy, I think provides a lot of both habit security as well as makes me feel good about myself, which during especially those first couple of months was a hard thing to find. And so finding those things, especially for grievers, and it doesn't necessarily have to be those specific items, I think is helpful and meaningful.
Oh, Ethan, you have an incredible story. It's been a pleasure to listen today. It'll be a pleasure to share it with our listeners, of course. Alice, do you have any other questions at all for Ethan? If not, feel free to close this out.
No. Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story. This is incredibly powerful.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as replacement for medical advice. The views expressed during this episode by hosts and our guests are their own and do not reflect the official position of their institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at PedesCritPodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @CritPeds and @PedesCrit on Instagram for real-time show updates. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review in your favorite podcasting application and share with your colleagues. Also, if you'd like to support the making of the podcast, please see the description for Venmo information and how to become a Patreon. Any donation will be appreciated. Thank you again for listening, and goodbye.